This fourth day of April will come to order, please. Our first bill on the agenda is House File 1229, a bill that provides for an election to detach land from a new school district. For a new school district. Welcome to the committee, Representative Biskins. Would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that House File 1229 be recommended pass and be referred to Committee on Education Finance.
And Representative Biskins, I see an amendment. Would you like to offer that to get the bill in the order in which you want?
Yes, Madam Chair. That is my amendment. I'd like to move the H1229A3 amendment.
Representative Biskins moves the H1229A3 amendment. Representative Biskins, would you like to tell us about that amendment, please?
Madam Chair, members, this amendment simply clarifies the section that deals with how the new school boards, once there's been an approval for the creation of a new school district, how the new boards would be created. And this clarifies. There was some confusion in the old language. This makes clarification.
Thank you, Representative Biskins. I believe that council has a recommended change. Ms. Larson.
Madam Chair, members, thank you. On the document H1229A3, on page 2, line 1, delete both. And on page 2, line 2, after the first "and," insert "subsequently, comma, if a resident of the district, comma."
Madam Chair.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, if I could ask Ms. Larson to repeat that.
Ms. Larson.
Madam Chair, Representative Biskin's members, on the document H1229A3, page 2, line 1, delete both. Page 2, line 2, after the first "and," insert "subsequently, comma, if a resident of the district, comma."
So, members, again, on page 2, line 1, delete both. And on line 2, after the first "and," insert "subsequently, comma, if a resident of the district, comma." And thank you, Ms. Larson, for repeating that for us. Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Will you accept those changes?
Having supreme confidence in our staff, I'd like to incorporate that into my
Representative Biskins incorporates those two changes into his amendment, H1229A3. And Representative Biskins, this is not a delete all, so... is there any discussion on the amendment? Hearing none, all those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, say no. The amendment is adopted. Representative Biskins, your bill now is in order. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Just to give you a gist of what this piece of legislation proposes, in current law, as you all know, we have a process by which two geographical land areas can come together to form a new school district. Two school districts can come together to form a new school district. Happens all the time. Of course, it's called consolidation. We also have a process in law, believe it or not, and it gets used so rarely, but there is a process in law by which a portion of a school district can petition to detach from its existing school district and attach to a contiguous school district. So if a family is, let's just say 50, let's say 12 miles away from the high school, that they are technically within the school district, and maybe 2 miles away from the high school in the next school district, and their farm or property abuts the neighboring school district, they can petition to detach and annex to the neighboring school district. It's not easy, and that's why we don't hear about it a lot. There's a lot of considerations that have to take place, most importantly, financial obligations, because in making that move, there is not, you know, you don't divorce yourself from any bond or levy obligations which had been voted in when you were part of the old school district. So all of that has to factor in and become part of the process. And that's a process in current law, rarely used, but used on an occasion. The one thing that I found strange, especially in this day and age when we're talking about schools and the value we're finding of smaller schools and its importance, there is no way in current law for a geographical area to actually try to detach from a school district and become its own school district. All right, I like to refer to this bill kind of as an unconsolidation bill, because right now, if two separate school districts, say they had consolidated in the early 60s to form one because of declining enrollment, etc., had come together to form one school district. And then let's say here we are 40 years later, growth has gotten to that area. And now, you know, we've got two cities who had a very proud high school tradition, each on their own, and they say, you know, we've grown enough, each of our cities could probably support our own school district, and we'd kind of like to have our districts back. Right now, there is no way in law for that to occur, short of the legislature rewriting school district boundaries, and we know how likely that will be, all right, in our lifetime. Slim and none, all right? So this bill would create a process by which that could happen, that a community could at least analyze the potentiality of creating their own school district. We all know how important the school is to the identity of a community. This bill would allow a community to at least look at and at least take the time to analyze what it would mean financially, what it would mean to the city, what it would mean to each and every taxpayer within a community. Right now, the thought is, why even bother to look, because there's no way this could happen. This at least creates a process. It's complicated. It is not going to be a cheap process, and that's why I think it should ought to go to a finance committee to have it looked at, but at least it gives a process. Madam Chair, that is my testimony. Basically, if I can describe the bill, I don't know if I can any better than Ms. Larson has, but on the House summary, it really, the gist of the bill takes place in Section 1, Subdivision 1, and I'll even shorten it more. Basically, what this bill does is allow a school board to act to place on the ballot at the next school district general election a question of whether to detach from the school district a specified area of district land, which then would become its own school district, and it requires a voter-approved detachment to be accomplished, and it sets out the rest of the bill, talks about how that can be accomplished. So that's the bill in a nutshell. I know that there are, Madam Chair, at least three people who would like to come forward and testify in support of this bill, and I would assume there's probably one or two who'd like to testify in opposition. But if I could have the supporters come forward now, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Diskins, and will those who are testifying in favor of House File 1229 please come to the testifying table? And maybe if we could add some chairs.
Hi, Madam Chair, committee members.
Welcome to the committee. Do we have two who are going to be at the table? Three. So we need an extra chair. If the page would please accommodate that. welcome to the committee, all three of you, and as you testify, please say your name for the record, and then proceed with your testimony. We can take one of you at a time, and let's start with our lady guest. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am Kathleen Polk. I'm a former Elk River Area School Board member, and I'm here to support House File 1229. ISD 728 is the 10th largest school district in the state of Minnesota, with over 10,000 students. Within 10 years, the school district is projecting a student population of 17,000. The district is 24 miles long and 7.5 miles wide. It covers 5 counties. Those are Hennepin, Anoka, Wright, Sherburne, and we throw in Isanti, even though there are only 4 registered voters in Isanti County. The Mississippi River divides the district very nicely, with Rogers and Otsego south of the river and Elk River Zimmerman to the north. This bill would allow growing districts to become more locally directed. It would allow districts such as ours to divide before it becomes too large to manage the diverse needs that the very near future will bring. Splitting a district like ISD 728 that is in both the metro and greater Minnesota will help all our students. Specific needs in each community can be addressed by the members of that community. For example, if there is a special programming, educational need, a school, or other facility needed in the Rogers-Otsego community, parents in the Elk River Zimmerman community who may not have those very same needs will not need to approve or pay for bonds and levies that are not in the best interest of their community. Likewise, Elk River Zimmerman will not need the approval of Rogers and Otsego residents for their bonds, levies, and programming needs. I would like to thank you for your time and interest in House File 1229, which gives voters a stronger voice in local educational needs. And as an afterthought, but our local newspaper is doing a survey right now. And according to the survey, 43% support the split of the school district. 26% support this body allowing voters to split, any school district to split. And 4% say that as a body, you should make the decision all on your own. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Houghton. I represent Princeton, so I know all about your growth in the Elk River, Zimmerman, Rogers at Seago area. Sir, welcome to the committee. Why don't we take the gentleman in the middle next? Be sure you use the microphone that Ms. Poach was using. Say your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Gregory Lind. I am a resident of Savage. A few comments. We do live in an area where there's a tremendous amount of growth also in that area. As Representative Buskin said earlier, many communities in Minnesota have seen mergers over the years. And as a result, many communities have lost their identity, their sense of community, and have seen test scores drop as a part of a larger mega district. In recent years, some of those same communities are seeing a large amount of growth, as I mentioned earlier. Those same mega districts are getting bigger, just as the example with Elk River. It has been reported in several reports that are available on the Internet that smaller districts provide higher quality education. There's one by the Northwest Regional Educational Laboratory, Minnesota Extension Services Project Future, and the Center for Rural Policy and Development. There's a range when a district is too small that doesn't have the fiscal support to operate efficiently, and a district that's too large loses touch with the needs of the students. All three reports detail these findings. Our community has conducted several surveys over the past 8 years. As recently as the past month, another survey to help our community plan for the next 15 to 20 years. As a part of our visioning process, the category of most serious issues facing our community listed schools at 11%, which was in third. The top two were growth at 28% and taxes at 22%. It was also noted that a school district referendum passed recently on the western half of our city, which is the Prior Lake Savage School District 719, was a potential influence on the taxes category. On several open-ended questions on the survey, questions regarding what residents would like to see, where our own school district for our community was repeatedly mentioned. This legislation would give us the mechanism to explore the possibility of creating a new district from existing districts and benefiting all of those affected districts. The people of the community have no power to solve the problem of their own. Existing school boards are concerned about dollars per pupil funding their district and not the needs of the specific community. My neighborhood itself is cut into two districts. I have a neighborhood of 149 homes, one exit in and out of the neighborhood, yet there are six buses in the morning and six buses in the evening. There are families that are three doors down from me that have to go to a high school 8 miles away when there's one less than a half mile from my home. That seems like a waste of that these dollars could be put towards books or teaching materials. There are so many benefits to the children of these communities: quality, community identity, and the quality of the education. We need to have this option available to the people of the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lind. Sir, welcome to our committee. Are you Mr. Neville?
No, I'm not. Madam Chair and committee members, thank you for the opportunity today. My name is Rob Fendler, and I am a former three-term mayor for the city of Savage. I have also deeply involved in the community through the Chamber of Commerce and the Junior Chamber of Commerce before that. So I guess I have a good sense of the community itself and all the things that are being said. And the thing that I hear time and time again is why can't Savage have its own district? Well, as Representative Biskin said, there is no such law that allows it at this point in time. So, I mean, then that's the answer we had to give them. And people can't understand how the school district boundaries were drawn, and you have to explain to them every time that it's the farmers that went this way or that way. I just think that at this point in time, with the districts all consolidating from, you know, the early 40s, from 7,600 of them or something down to 400 and some, you know, I think that was the thing to do. I mean, that's an ideal situation. But at this point in time, with the swelling of those districts, I think there comes a point in time where it's just not as economically feasible to sustain that and do the best job for that district. We all know that with Minneapolis, and I'm exaggerating with that because Burnsville Savage has probably 11,000 to 12,000 students. So we're not near that, but in our sense and in our hearts and minds, we kind of think we're getting to that point where it's become more of an issue, where it's bigger is not always better. So that's what we're here to support, this House File 1229, and hope that it moves forward. As Greg said, we have kids that are in one neighborhood that the south side of the street goes to the Prior Lakes Savage and the north side goes to the Burnsville Savage Egan district, and we just don't feel that that's fair to the kids. And at boundaries of in our particular case, we would be looking at Savage city boundaries, possibly make things a whole lot easier, and those are defined a lot easier by creeks and rivers and railroad tracks, where we're not splitting neighborhoods right in half. So at this point in time, we just feel that the numbers are there that Savage could support its own district. There's also all the other reasons of community identity, neighbors going to different schools. I think that you'd have, and not that we don't have that now with a lot of parents, and I don't mean to demean in any way parents' participation. There are a lot of good ones out there, but I think that having one within your own community, you're going to get a lot more involvement and support, not only from parents, but businesses as well. They're just people get a little bit more disconnected when the schools are over in the next town. And I know that as a business owner myself. I support the school systems wholeheartedly as much as I can. I have a business that's in Savage. I live in Savage. I've been there for, you know, over 20-plus years. So I do know that, and I'm in touch with the business world as well. So that's why I say that I do know that people get disconnected when you don't have it right within your own city boundaries. I think it'll just help. And we all know that that helps towards education. And I guess the bottom line, you know, there's several of these reasons of possibly why to do it, for community identity and the kids and so forth. But there's been a lot of studies, and I think that that's maybe something to look into a little farther, is the studies of how the kids, the dollars per child. We know that there's a point where you can't have 15 kids in a school district and have a per pupil rate the same as you do when you have 1,000 or 4,000. But there are studies out there that show that there is a point where that makes more sense. And I think as you get into the larger districts, the money somehow starts to go away. You do have more dollars to offer more programs, but is that just offering more programs, or are you actually getting a better education? So there's a lot to deal with that as well. I think of, as they say, the most part, there's a lot of reasons, but I think the most part is the education part of it. It's not always bigger is better, and we just feel that we would like this mechanism so that if possibly it's Savage or Elk River or whoever, we're hearing more talk all the time as we get a little farther into this. It's all new to us. I'm glad to see somebody else here supporting this bill as well who, you know, we've had no contact with. We just know there are other people out there supporting this, and I'm sure there'll be more coming forward. But all we're asking for is that this move forward just to have that mechanism if somebody wants to have to do this.
Thank you very much, Mr. Fendler. Ms. Pote, do you know how many have been surveyed in the Star News so far?
Do I have to admit?
No, you don't. No.
I do have the number, and I don't mind because it's only going on a couple of days. The total vote so far has been 157, and it's an online survey, certainly not scientific.
Well, that's what I wondered, if it wasn't an online survey. So the word is getting out gradually, but that's... That's good. That's good. Are there any others who would like to testify in favor of House File 1229?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Mr. Fenwick.
I do have a short letter here from somebody that sent it along with us, if you wouldn't mind if I read that in support of.
Can you summarize it, perhaps?
It's
very short. Yes, go ahead, Mr.
Fenler,
and read it. Yes, please.
Appreciate it. Thank you. As a mother of a 6-year-old and an active member of the City of Savage, I have served on the Park and Rec Task Force and presently serve on the Planning Commission in the City of Savage. I believe that our children are our most important resource. I believe it is hard for the children in our neighborhood to have the opportunities to play and grow close to their neighbors when they attend different school districts in different schools in different school districts. The school districts that exists in my neighborhood are 191 and 719, and they do not even schedule their school breaks at the same time. I believe our districts have gotten too large and at times too political. Schools exist to teach our children basic skills. Social skills are also part of our schooling experience. I would like to see our children in community schools with their neighbors. Smaller school districts have been shown to provide improved test scores on basic skills tests. Smaller school districts can concentrate on the needs of the children. Minnesota is a leader in the field of education. Let's make the right decision for our children's sake. And that's Leslie Husted, River Oak Drive in Savage. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fendler. Seeing no others wanting to testify in favor of this bill, will those who want to testify against the bill please come forward? Welcome to the committee, Mr. Deans. Please say your name for the record.
Madam Chair, my name is Tom Deans. I'm legal counsel of the School Board Association. Madam Chair, I'll try to be brief on this bill. There's two or three issues that I'd like to raise with the bill generally, and then I'd just like to speak broadly to the financial issue, and I know that that'll be dealt with more when we get to Ed Finance. The first issue I'd like to bring up is that this question can be put on the ballot by a petition that's brought by at least 50 electors of the district, or 10% of the votes cast in the most recent school board election. That can be a pretty small number for an issue like this. The only thing that's similar to this kind of an election is the present law that provides for dissolution of an entire district and attachment to other districts. That law is in place. That law requires a petition by a majority of the eligible voters in the school district. I think what you have to understand is, and I'll get to this in a little bit, this is a huge financial commitment when you do this. Because under this bill, all the assets are divided between the two communities, or the two school districts. Each school district is going to be 50% short when you get done doing that dividing. and you're going to need to have bond issues in each district to deal with those shortages. The equipment, the supplies, there'll be have to be new schools that are built in the other school district, and that creates a huge problem. We think we understand that the issue has to go to the voters, and the voters have to approve it. But we think that this sort of an issue should have a greater number bringing the issue forward. I guess I don't want to get into the election issues that are in here. I think that we'll just let those be taken care of. They've addressed some of the stuff with the bonded debt. As I say, I think each district would have to come up with some way to finance what you're short, because the bill provides that what you do is once the two districts are established, you divide the assets between those school districts. So this one would get half the equipment, this one would get half the equipment, this one would get half the books, this one would get half the books, this would get half the uniforms, this one would get half the uniforms. This, to the extent that there's real property that's being transferred, that's paid for by a levy that's done under the judgments levy, which means that it would be paid for within 3 years. And that amount in a fast-growing district like this for a school site could be $20 to $30 million. To the extent that we have a high school in the district now, and the new district doesn't get a high school, or the new district gets the high school and the old one doesn't, somebody's going to have to build a new high school. And that's going to cost, a new high school costs somewhere in the metro area anyway, somewhere between $40 and $80 million. Also, we haven't dealt with taking school districts apart for 50 years or so. Consolidation has incentives, those laws, to deal with some of these issues. You know, somebody's, let's just take the uniforms, even though I hate to bring that up, but the uniforms are only good for one of the districts. They can't be, both of them can't wear the same team uniform, so somebody's got to get new uniforms. Somebody's got to get new band uniforms. Somebody's got to do that stuff. It's just, you normally have given in consolidation situations, you've often given levy authority for that. If this passes, I think people will be in for levy authority. But one of the things that you have to understand is on these division of assets provisions, and that nobody has done this way for 50 years. And these laws are not the best. But let me give you an example. One of the things that this does is it divides up the staff between the two districts. And the way that the law does that is you figure out which district has the most kids after you do the division. Say this district gets 1,500 kids and this district gets 1,000. The one that gets 1,500 kids gets the most senior teacher. The next district gets the next most senior. The next one gets the third most senior. And it goes back and forth like that till all the teachers are divided. In today's world, I think that's kind of an odd way to run this. I think that if you pass this, given the levy implications alone, I'm afraid that you will have to carry $20 to $40-50 million in the K-12 bill to cover the levy implications of this because of the way the House allocates levy. That's something for Representative Sikora's committee, but I guess we'd rather have, if you're going to do that, we'd rather have that $50 million on the formula. Thank you, Madam.
Thank you, Mr. Deans. Are there any others who wish to testify in opposition to House File 1229? Representative Viskins, welcome back to the table. Representative Greiling has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Viskins, I'm wondering given the school board testimony and the possible cost, if you considered having this option be where a portion of a school district could attach to a different school district.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Representative Growling, that process is already in law. This is a completely, this to me fills in the final piece of processes that are in law. As I said before, this process, we know consolidation, two districts coming together. There is a process in law for a portion of a district to detach from one and attach to the other. That, and you know, Representative Greiling, we rarely hear about it because it is an expensive process. You know, just I concur with what Mr. Dean said. It is an expensive process. It's not, and I'm not meant to make something real easy that everyone can do. But according to current law right now, why even bother to think about it? Because there's no way it can happen. At least I'm creating, what I'm trying to do here is create a process where people can at least say, well, let's look into it. Right, and it'll be expensive. I concur with Mr. Dean. I think the uniform issue is an interesting one. I thought maybe one team could get the home jerseys and the other get the away jerseys. I don't know if that would work. But you know, I concur with what he says. And there will be a fiscal note that will be brought forward if, in this committee's judgment, this bill moves on to finance.
Representative Saylor.
Madam Chair and Representative Biskins, I was just wondering what level of support exists throughout the state for something like this? Is it only this district or these districts that might have an interest in this? I'm a little concerned about the potential for opening up more of the interesting scenarios we see between townships and cities with annexation and the situations that go on there. I just wonder if maybe this is something that, if indeed it came from folks in this district, that it might be better to have it only apply to this district, or is this something that we want to get into statewide?
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Saylor. You know, in my 7 years here, I typically, you know, in committees that I go to, when people bring local bills, hear just the opposite. Well, if it's good for the goose, why not for the gander? Why are we creating special laws because, you know, you've got one school district, then next year you've got two more of these, then the next year you've got a third. You know, to me it's just, if we're going to create the process by which it can be analyzed, why shouldn't it be a statewide process? You know, there is a bill in the purview of this committee right now which does look at a very specific school district, all right? And their ability to, you know, want to break apart into two school districts. So, you know, I've always been one to say, you know, let's look at the big picture at this level. Let's not micromanage local issues. I see this as a current hole in our process, and so that's why I moved the bill forward in the shape I have.
Representative Saylor, did you have a follow-up? Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Representative Biskins, I certainly appreciate your comments on that and can see that they make sense in so many cases. But I guess I also, again, kind of revisit this annexation situation and also looking at some other things with different types of districts. When a door is opened, sometimes a small part of the population has been unhappy with a judgment or whatever from local government and then proceeds to, this could happen with watershed districts. And I realize we're talking different things, and yet the same type of situation can occur, and I would just, I guess, be cautious or want to be cautious about opening up doors for smaller parts of the population to say, well, this law exists, let's try and divide the district, when that may not be the wish of the entire district.
Representative Biskins?
Madam Chair, you know, there is a referendum that's required in this piece of legislation.
Representative Peterson.
My concern deals with particularly the school closings in the metropolitan area. This seems like a small number of people, discontent people with closing of a school, who could go after this kind of a vote. And you know, I live in a community with seven cities. and none of them are represented entirely within the school district. And you know, so in the metropolitan area, it's a very different kind of situation. And I do have concerns about what this might mean. Having gone through a closing of the high school, if you recall, in Robbinsville a while back, if this had been in place, I could have seen them just dissolving. So there are a lot of pitfalls with this particular kind of bill, in my opinion.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Biscuits.
Madam Chair and Representative Peterson, while I can appreciate that the 50 electors or 10%, the number one is whichever is larger, all right? But number two, that doesn't mean they can now detach and become their own district. All that says is that it should then go out to the voters. It's still going to have to be 50% plus one of the votes cast before this can move forward. So I can understand that the 50 electors or 10% sounds small, mm-hmm. but that doesn't make it happen. What makes it happen is 50% plus one. It's the exact same threshold that makes the difference between myself being a legislator and being a very content volunteer fireman. Right.
Representative Sharon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My district would be very interested in this bill, considering that in the Stillwater School District, the cities of Lake Elmo, Baytown, Bayport, West Lakeland, Oak Park Heights are all part of the Stillwater School District and one of the fastest growing areas of the Twin Cities, and I know that they're going to be very interested in being able to have this at least to consider as part of their options.
Representative Sharon, did you have a question? Or just
of course
comment?
Not.
Thank you. Representative Ethan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Fiskins. I share the concern that you've expressed about the small schools and trying to do something that would, save these small school environments that I think are very healthy learning environments. Up in our area, we've already lost one small elementary school that was closed as a result of financial problems, facing possibly two more in my district that may be closed now. A lot of these small elementary schools were saved because the schools are the heart of the communities there. And I was wondering if this bill would allow for a school district to be formed around an elementary school. For instance, in Callaway, where there's an elementary school that is part of the Detroit Lakes School District. They're discussing the possibility of closing that school now. Would it be possible under this bill for the community of Callaway to form their own school district around the elementary?
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Eakin. I'm not quite sure. I do know we have a district in the state of Minnesota that has no schools, all right? So it might be, I don't see where the prohibition against having a school district that has only a high school and some agreement, but maybe Ms. Larson can clarify that. I just don't know if you can, but I would think it may be possible through open enrollment in particular, that when a child gets to X grade, now they must open enroll to a neighboring district. I would think that's possible.
Mr. Deans, could you address that issue? Would you come to the table and respond to whether or not a district can be organized around an elementary school? Welcome. Sure. Say your name for the record,
Tom,
please.
Deans. My understanding of the current law is that in order for a school district to exist, it has to have a K-12 program. There are options where you can have pairing agreements that were part of that provided in one district and part of that's provided in another district. But without that pairing agreement being in place at the time the district is created, it would immediately be subject to mandatory consolidation.
Thank you, Mr. Deans. Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just thinking in school district we share, you're smarter than this. It was mentioned once or twice that in the city of Eagan that maybe Eagan should have their own school district. If we were going to do that, not that I'm saying we want to, but if someone wanted to do that, it would still take 51% of the entire district. So if Apple Valley and Rosemont and the other half of Eagan that doesn't go to Eagan High School wanted to, didn't want that to happen, they could stop it. And it probably wouldn't go forward very easily. Is that a true statement?
Representative Biskins.
Madam Chair, almost Representative Wardlow, because I think you left off Burnsville and Mendota Heights also, who would have a say in this, because they all belong to 196.
You're absolutely right.
My
focus was on Eagan High School, as always.
Yes. But to answer your question, Representative Wardlow, yes, the way the bill is constructed, all right, while it may be just one city in a multi-city school district that would want to do this, the vote is still of the entire district.
Representative Dietrich.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a comment, and then I'll summarize with a question. And I have a great interest in this bill because I come from the Anoka-Hennepin School District, and we have talked about this for many, many years. There are many people who would love to split the school district. And as people have talked to me about that, I have taken that under consideration often. And then I really need to step back and look at somewhat of the equity issues or the, I will call the state interest involved. And I think that there are some things that we are that we haven't brought up here today that that I would be very interested in pursuing. And first of all, is when we're making these new boundaries or suggesting new boundaries, does anybody take into consideration the property wealth of each area? Because we all know that property wealth is an asset or can be a real detriment to a school district, depending on how much you have or don't have. The other thing is the population breakdown. Is anybody going to watch and make sure that we have at least we don't have lopsided poor families, that the socioeconomic balance of the district is now in a balance that we can at least effectively educate, because we all know that pockets of poverty do create real serious issues. The other would be English-speaking students having unbalanced pockets of people who cannot speak English, and what that does to the cost then of educating, and then does the property wealth of that district or that new area then support that? I think there are many issues besides those that have been brought up here that go into that. But saying that, I would support the ability to be able to look at that. But I would say that should not be done by population suggestions, by signing a petition, because we all know it's very easy to sign your name onto a petition without having the long-term ramifications of what you're asking for. I would say we ought to take a look at the whole state and take a look at where our state has moved in the last 50 years and how should we redistrict it. We do that with legislative districts according to population and balance and all that type of thing. And I think the time has come. I really do. I think it's an excellent idea.
Okay. Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, Representative Dietrich, thank you for your thoughtful comments. I hope I can put them a little bit at ease by saying if this bill is moved forward, I would love to continue to work with you on firming some things up, but hopefully put your mind a little bit even more at ease by pointing your attention to page 1, line 12. The second word on line 12, I think, is a very important word, right? And that is that the word may. Right. There's nothing in here which obligates the school board to actually put it on the ballot, even with a petition. So you do. This is a real grassroots effort. All right. You do have the people nearest to the communities involved looking at all of the ramifications and making the important decision as to whether or not this should indeed move forward. All right. So that, I hope, gives you a little bit of comfort language or comfort level. You know, I understand the creation of the poor and the wealthy districts, the creation of the pockets of poverty, the creation of the pockets of LEP students, but those things already exist, all right? They exist by the simple creation of our school districts. I don't know if we'll ever totally undo those without some massive busing campaign that I don't think we're going to go down that road, but... you know, the state has acknowledged those as issues, all right? For property poor districts, we have a thing called equity funding for students or school districts that have high levels of low income students. We have compensatory revenue. We have LEP revenue. So, you know, we've taken a lot of people say maybe not to the level we need to, and I understand those debates and appreciate them. But, you know, those components are all there. Again, you know, if this bill does get raised with the members' vote to move it forward, I would like to have the opportunity to continue to work with this representative.
Representative Carlson.
Yes, Madam Chair, I have a couple of questions. One is maybe more in the category of a suggestion, but okay. If the bill moves forward, for many years, I've been an advocate of school boards that are made up of an uneven number.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen situations through the years where, on certain issues, when you have a six-member board, it deadlocks and it becomes difficult to make a decision, even to the point where I know one school district had to go to a form of arbitration to resolve a major issue. So just something to think about, a five or a seven board member, then you can be sure to arrive at a decision in a timely way. The other question I have, what happens to membership? And I do apologize if you touched on either of these, as you well know, because I was up in Ways and Means, sitting right across from you part of the thing. Although it improved tonight, down to two committees instead of three like I had over the noon hours. So. The question I have is the intermediate school districts. If a district, a new district is in effect created, what are its obligations to other tax-supported organizations like the intermediate district? And is that a new decision has to be made, or would that membership automatically carry forward? You know, for example, I'm in the 287 service area. Not every school district, though, in suburban Hennepin that would be eligible historically chose to be. 13 of the school districts did. But if you were to have one of the districts break up, then what would be their standing relative to those programs and participation?
Representative Fiskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, first to your initial suggestion, changing the six-member board to a five or seven, I was hoping for a strong superintendent position, all right, being a school administrator. Maybe I could get one of those jobs where I could actually vote on a school. No, I'm kidding. I think that's a very valid statement and one I will take to heart if this moves forward. The other piece, I think, maybe covered on page 2, subdivision 4, where it talks about current assets and liabilities and the commissioner making issuing an order. Now, I tend to think that your membership in intermediate school districts is a quote-unquote liability of the current district and therefore would be the obligation of both of the new districts formed by this bill, but I can work with staff later to make sure we firm that up.
Madam Chair, maybe a correct interpretation. I didn't quite read it that way, so you may want to, if the bill moves forward, clarify those names. Those are quite. Would be, Madam Chair, there'd be the X students. You know, there are different regional groups.
Mm-hmm.
Seeing no other questions, closing remarks, Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I'd appreciate your support.
Representative Root, I'm sorry. Did you have a question?
I was just, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, is there a threshold or how many students would it take to form a new school district?
Representative Biskins.
Madam Chair, Representative Root, there is no threshold in this bill. And again, you know, I come back to page 1, line 12, where the school board may make that decision. You know, I'm going to hope and keep my fingers crossed, trust to the decision making of the folks at the grassroots nearest the issue.
Representative Biskins renews his motion that House File 1229 as amended pass and be referred to the Committee on Education Finance. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no.
No.
The motion does prevail, and this bill is re-referred to Education Finance.
Thank you,
Representative Biskins.
Members.
Representative Greiling, House File 827.
You can't leave it, this guy.
Oh, you know, where's your mic? Welcome, Representative Greiling. Would you like to move your bill and tell us where you would like it to be sent?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I would like to move House File 827 and forward it on to Education Finance for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Representative Greiling moves House File 827 to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance. Representative Greiling, please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is a bill that I worked on with the world language teachers and some of them who are with me. And I became interested when they approached me a couple of years ago. I had just returned with my husband from Germany, and we had had a nice trip where we became aware, looking at the educational system there, how far advanced the other countries of the world are when we compare ourselves to them, where they have little children coming into kindergarten already speaking one language and starting to work on another one. We also have a global society, and we have heard in our other committees here at the legislature how some jobs are being outsourced to the other side of the world, to countries like India, because they speak perfect English and can work while we are sound asleep. So if our students could learn other languages, we could do their work while they're sleeping in the middle of the night. So businesses look for applicants who speak other languages, because often there's international travel, and it even involves national security. The military is very interested in other people, in people who can speak other languages. So that's kind of the premise for the bill. We last year had a bill that wasn't heard, just to add world language as another standard, but the more that we discussed it, other states that have tried doing that, it's really not the best approach, because there isn't any groundwork done. And also the thought, which I share, that we should start smaller with how many standards we have, so we don't snow under the school district. So this kind of puts us on a shorter or a longer time frame. And so the bill designates, asks the Commissioner of Education to designate a full-time coordinator for world language at the state level. And the coordinator surveys the school districts, identify what's being done, looks at staff development, successful models in other states, and then also can award up to 6 grants to school districts, either established or new, that will pilot some of these ideas. Madam Chair, I'm going to turn it over now to the testifiers that I have here. I'm not sure what order they'll go in. I'll introduce both of them and let them take over. Jan Holter Kiddick has been a Spanish teacher for many years, and including at the Concordia Language Villages in Wayzata, at St. Clair Public Schools, and is currently a principal licensure candidate at Hamline University. Anita Ratwick, who many of you have seen in the audience here for quite a while, putting in a lot of time trying to understand this place as a volunteer and then working on this bill, is with Minnesota New Visions, Language for Life. She's Minnesota's nominee for the work that she's done on this bill for National World Language Teacher of the Year for 2005. She's a candidate for National Board Certification and chairs a national committee that's developed criteria for world languages. And she has, Representative Heidgerken is here. She has taught German for over 20 years. So I will, Madam Chair, I know they have a video and some comments, and then we will stand for questions.
Representative Greiling, I have a couple amendments before me. Is one of them or both of them yours?
Oh, I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I meant to do that. There was one that Ms. Larson
maybe
prepared.
The A2? Yes, H0827A2 committee. I believe is Representative
okay.
Greiling's
yes,
amendment.
Madam Chair, I would like to move these amendments to get it in the shape that we would like. I would like to move amendment A2. And,
Representative Greiling moves H0827A2. Is there any discussion? And thank you, Representative Greiling, for making it generic rather than specific.
Okay. Right.
All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. The amendment is adopted. Okay, Representative Greiling, we'll move to your testifiers, and let's begin with Ms. Kinnock. Welcome to the committee. Say your name for the record.
Jan Kinnock. Good evening, Madam Chair and committee members. Thank you for hearing this bill. World languages are an integral part of an education that prepares our students for the global society of the 21st century. This bill proposes startup funding for model extended sequence world language programs. The funding will act as a catalyst for strengthening K-12 education in this area. Why do we need to invest in world languages? We'll begin with a short video produced for state-level policymakers, boards of education, and other educational leaders. It will address why more emphasis on world languages is needed. One, for national security interests. Two, for competitiveness in a global marketplace. And three, for the cognitive and social development of our students. Afterwards, Ms. Radwick and I will expand on these three areas.
Hi, I'm Morley Safer. I'm here at Asia Society, and I'd like to talk to you about one of the most urgent challenges we face as a nation. September 11th and events since have made it crystal clear how interconnected we are with the rest of the world, and that international knowledge and skills are vital to our country's future. If we're going to survive and prosper, we need to know about other cultures, Asia, Africa, Latin America, the Middle East. They cannot remain a mystery. This is especially true with our children. They're the ones who have to live in a world that may be fundamentally different from the one we've known. It's all been changing so fast, and the stakes can't be higher.
In these times, our safety and our prosperity depend on our knowledge of the world around us.
Safety and prosperity, national security and economic opportunity. Much depends on the 90% of the world that lives beyond our borders. And we've got to prepare our children for this interconnected future.
The world is our neighborhood. You've got to know your neighborhood.
If the world is our neighborhood, there's plenty of evidence we might have lost our way. Asia Society and National Geographic Society surveys have exposed an alarming gap in even the most basic knowledge of the world.
25% of our students who are high school students, college bound, can't name the ocean between the United States and Asia. These students that may be learning more about reading and math and science are still woefully ignorant about the world.
Like it or not, our future success now depends on a new kind of literacy, international literacy.
People in this country don't realize that U.S. trade with Asia surpassed that with Europe in 1979. It's never looked back.
In fact, future jobs in business, government, health care, law enforcement, and a wide variety of other fields will all require international knowledge and skills. The world is now our real marketplace, and to make it, our kids must have the tools to compete.
The markets that our corporations will serve are international, and they need those who are conversant in other cultures and other languages.
I think languages are crucial, but the importance of languages like Chinese and Japanese are just becoming known.
From an economic standpoint, there's no question in my mind that the education level, skill level, sensitivity around international issues needs to raise way up.
And it's not just the major multinationals.
Our economy is global. We might be surprised at how many small local businesses really have an international reach.
From a family fishing business in New England, to a machine parts exporter in California, to a small farmer in the Midwest, everyone has to have what it takes to compete.
Our young people are going to have to be able to negotiate throughout the world. And that's the bottom line.
Our future well-being faces both challenge and opportunity. War, disease, hunger, human rights, and the environment, all are issues that impact this country now.
Issues such as global climate change, people who are studying faults and earthquakes, people who are looking at preserving species diversity. These are global in their scope.
There's a need for people to be proactive in the world to address these issues. And it's not just in one country, it's everywhere.
We are facing a major crisis because it's our generation that will one day inherit the problems internationally that we currently face and then some.
I believe that the recent experiences have heightened the realization that it's not a luxury, that this is a necessity in education.
But our current education system just hasn't kept pace with a changing world.
What we have to focus on is, what are kids learning, and what are the skills that they are acquiring, and are they learning enough about Asia, about the world? And the answer is no.
Our kids are actually hungry for information.
There's a yearning for the students to make sense of how do all the other players in the world fit together.
Without the right tools, it's impossible to do the job.
And here, the failure to teach languages, the failure to teach history and comparative cultures is becoming a major liability.
Now, more than ever, it's critical that educators have the resources to bring the world to their students.
Not only is international knowledge not expected of K-12 students generally, but it's certainly not expected of teachers yet in their own preparation for certification.
The good news is, there are models for success.
Who lives in North America?
Everybody in this class.
One example, this school in Massachusetts. At this public elementary school, getting an early start in learning about the world brings the basic skills of reading, writing, and arithmetic to life in whole new ways.
If we traveled and you were going to go shopping for groceries in China, what would you do?
In China, you don't really, there isn't really a price.
I think the kids are so curious about the world around them. So in our teaching about the world, we connect it with what's happening with children in other places in the world, and it's very engaging. Many children that I teach have had world experiences by the age of 7. The children that they have class with have come from other places in the world.
The rest of the world is much different than here. I think it's kind of fun to see other different things that we don't have here.
Everyone, we're going to start today with the Latin American reading.
Another case in point, this high school near Chicago. Here, international content is part of the core curriculum. Asian language studies.
It's still occurring in places around the world, and I think that really, really struck me reading this.
Exploring world literature.
When students read literature from other cultures, they become fascinated by the cultures, and they also develop tremendous compassion for the people within that culture.
About their views on the two.
It's a place where learning about the world can also take kids on fascinating virtual journeys.
The internet is a great resource for obviously educating them or finding out how they can be more relevant in a global sense, and the kinds of resources that are on the internet to teach them about different cultures, to teach them about different languages, to teach them about how people think. It's all there.
Coming up so well. I'm so happy.
The whole immersion into Japanese culture. Did you see something from another point of view that you don't really get to see?
A global studies type of course gives them enough of a focus where they can really get into that culture. It could be language, history, literature, and really immerse themselves in it.
I think since September 11th, students have been a lot more interested in politics and a lot more interested in international issues.
Especially now, with more like the whole situation in Iraq and North Korea, people are more interested about what's going on in the world and what other people think about it.
The 10 nations sign a kind of a treaty.
Since international awareness is no longer a luxury, we've got to make programs like these the rule rather than the exception.
I've mentioned several times about my Beijing trip.
As a school, we have sponsored trips of taking students and teachers overseas in order to educate themselves and expose students to the culture.
International education is also a two-way street. We need to show others who we really are.
There's tremendous misinformation about the United States in many parts of the world. We badly need an expansion of two-way education projects so that young people around the world can learn about each other.
Global studies opens kids' eyes up to feelings and emotions, empathy, compassion. It far extends the classroom.
Many resources for making changes in our schools already exist.
No one believes that we're talking about adding another subject for students called international studies. What we're talking about is in their reading preparation, in their science preparation, in their history preparation, broadening what they do, and certainly enhancing their language study.
This kind of work promotes the old skills, communication, writing, analytical thinking, and really a reflection on the views of others who have had different kinds of experiences.
It's a matter of developing ways to turn ideas into action.
And I would suggest that a governor appoint a statewide commission on international education to learn about what's going on in the schools of their state.
Schools of education can assess their own teacher education programs. They can work with states and districts to see where international content can enrich the curriculum.
I think there's a need for action now. And it's not just at the top. And it's not just for some elite group that's going to be working on foreign policy.
Look at the big picture. And you'll see that the 21st century is a time of vast opportunities on a global scale. Not just business opportunities, but also opportunities to end centuries-old conflicts, to wipe out threat of diseases, to lift hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. Unbounded opportunity. Seize it.
A secure and prosperous future depends on the next generation, our kids. And they depend on us to prepare them. It's time to put the world into world-class education. Already, more than a dozen states and many schools are at work on plans to close the international knowledge gap. Here are some ways you can make a lasting difference in our schools and in the world, beginning right in your own community. Analyze what's already in place in the curriculum, in teacher preparation, in the community's connections to the world. Highlight best practices. Spread the word about innovative programs that may exist in one school or classroom. Develop a plan. Increase the number of students learning about Asia, Africa, Latin America, the Middle East, and world languages. Support professional development. Reward teachers and principals' creativity in developing international programs. And give them opportunities to increase their own international knowledge. Reach out. Many businesses and community organizations have international ties. Build partnerships with them. Look to local universities for additional resources. Engage parents. They're the ones who have to understand that knowledge of the world is critical to their children's future. Asia Society and other organizations have resources to help. Log on to askasia.org for teaching materials and internationaled.org for more resources and strategies to meet this urgent challenge starting now. I'm Morley Safer.
Hello.
Ms. Ratliff?
Sorry, we don't have... I'm sorry. Chair? I'm Anita Ratliff. I'm very glad to be here and get in front of you. I'm trying to get used to what is going on here at the same time. I normally don't have to worry about microphones. I've been teaching junior high German for 20 years in St. Paul here, so never had a problem with being heard. I'm using my quiet voice. As we know from the video, I'm sorry, how do we turn this on? Oh my goodness, how could you focus it down? Because right now we can't even see this. I'm used to an overhead. Will it focus on its own? Yeah? I'm not sure that you can see that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'll take your word for it. We will move on here. From the video, it comes through loud and clear that world languages are an integral part of education for the 21st century. Not just in the area that they emphasized, but we know that that's also valid whether you're talking about Europe, South America, Africa, or any of the other areas around the world. You know, who is advocating for world languages? 2005 Year of Languages is something that's coming from multiple agencies, national agencies. You've had the U.S. Senate resolution that is in the back of the blue folder that we handed out to most of you when we met with you. The U.S. Congress, the U.S. Senate resolution, you have the U.S. House resolution that was passed also in March. And what I think is particularly interesting is what it resolves at the very end. The House bill is a companion bill to the Senate bill that you have. And down at the bottom here, it talks about supporting world language initiatives, even at the local level. Who else is pushing for world languages? The Department of Defense is. They felt strongly enough about the need for competent language speakers that back in June they called a national conference with the Department of Defense, Department of Education, State Department, American Council on the Teaching of Languages. And from it has come many of the initiatives that we are now starting to see grow, even some money coming from the federal level. The Department of Defense also, is making changes within their own ranks. And I know many of you have military service behind you. If you're an officer in the military now, so the Department of Defense announced today, this is last week, a major initiative to develop foreign language cultural expertise among its military and civilian members. It intends to improve the language skills of the officer corps in general, as well as consider ability in the promotion of general officers. We're talking the promotion here. A quote from Secretary Rumsfeld, we simply must develop a greater capacity for languages that reflect the demands of this century. No technology delivers this capability. It's a truly human skill. He goes on. Building a capabilities-based language requirement determination process and tracking language readiness. Seat requirements are gone. No more 2 years at the college level. You have to show what you can do now. Back to the proficiency base. Establishing foreign language ability criterion for general and flag officer advancement. We're back to the career point. Within the State Department, they have also beefed up considerably their requirements, their language requirements for anybody wishing advancement within their ranks. The I just mentioned the State Department too, the Department of Education. No Child Left Behind legislation includes foreign languages as a core subject. That's not new. American Council on the Teaching of Languages and Cultures. Surprisingly enough, it is these other agencies that are pushing for world languages. They are partnering with the American Council on the Teaching of Languages and Cultures. We would never turn our back on that type of an opportunity, but we are absolutely delighted with it. They're promoting a national policy on foreign language that would be developed. They are promoting the development of a national advisor and of a national advisory council to meet the needs of the 21st century. These people, and when I say that I'm talking about the agency people here, are adamant about the need for language competence. And this is a very, very long road. These needs are critical right now, but they're not going to be met overnight. They are not nominal partners in this initiative. They're shoulder-to-shoulder co-workers, and they're the preachers and the leaders in many cases. That's from the national level. We're also had this on papers in the newspapers last week. We're reporting the intelligence gathered before going into Iraq was worthless. Last fall, Senator Charles Grassley, Republican from Iowa, reported that the U.S. Department of Justice had over 123,000 hours of intelligence tapes going back before 9/11, still waiting to be translated. We've reached the point that they're destroying older tapes without any idea of what is on them, just to make room for more information being collected now. And this is one of the concerns that came up from the State Department, as well as from the military, talking about the national interest. In the business area, business in the 21st century has a great need for language competent workers also. You have this with your papers. Anybody else up here, there are extra copies up there. Exports are the fastest growing sector of Minnesota's economy, growing more than 10% last year, slightly ahead of the national figures. According to a report that Dee just released, February of 2005, some of the information was in another report, 2004. Only about 25% of Minnesota's smaller businesses export. 75% of our businesses, smaller businesses, are not yet exporting. 50% of Minnesota's mid-sized businesses export. About 55% of Minnesota's largest businesses export. You can see the potential here. Aside from the good news of the growth, nationally, we had a $600 billion trade deficit in 2004. We have this growth, and that's good news, but this national export deficit is serious. Minnesota doesn't keep track of its own deficit. Those figures aren't available. Of the companies not exporting, the most commonly listed reason for not doing so was that they did not know the language or the culture of the countries. The most common reason I hear to learn Chinese is because of the business potential there. That's true, but the same reason is true for other languages. Germany is Minnesota's fourth largest trading partner, and that's on the chart that you have from last quarter. Mexico is our eighth largest trade partner. France is our 10th largest trade partner. We have the teachers to start extended model programs in these languages right now. We need to increase the number of teachers to expand from this point to add teachers and programs in additional languages also. In Minnesota right now, we are also rapidly losing world language programs. There is in spite of the demand for Chinese programs, and in Minnesota right now, we have roughly 20 to 25 teachers of Chinese statewide. And St. Paul had K-12 Chinese programs. At Central High School, there were over 170 students. That's still in place. Ramsey Junior High Chinese program is still in place. Highland Park Senior High, with over 160 Chinese students, is still in place. Highland Park Junior still in place. Webster Elementary was cut 2 years ago because of the budget cuts. St. Paul Academy has high school Chinese. Minnetonka has high school and some of the junior high. Their junior high program may be cut. We haven't been able to confirm that. You can see that we don't have a lot, and even the ones we have still are subject to changes. With that, I just want to again bring this back to the focus that world languages learning in Minnesota is an integral part of our global education. This is going to take a long time to develop. Our program is very small. It's a very modest program. But through it, we will be able to start to develop more teachers. It will give us a stability that signals to our students in college that this is something that would be good for them to go into. And it is a carrot for Minnesota school districts. It is not a stick. With that, I'll turn it over to Ms. Kittock. Now that we think we have a handle on the technology.
The call for strengthening of world languages in education is coming from many places. Ms. Radwick spoke to the call for stronger world language programs coming from government and business. The call is also coming from a broad spectrum of the educational profession, well beyond the world language profession itself. Many national-level organizations have recently dedicated entire issues of their journals to this crisis. The National Association of Secondary School Principals, the American the Association for Supervision and Curriculum Development, the National Association of State Boards of Education. This is an issue that is being called for from many areas. And it's a curious thing. We need to do a reality check. We hear the call from government, from business, and from education to prepare our students with more advanced foreign language skills, knowledge of the world, and its cultures. That's what we hear on one hand, and on the other hand, we see nationwide a trend in reducing foreign language instruction. The equation does not balance. This is an article that you have in the materials distributed today. It's a background paper written by Dr. Carol Ann Dahlberg. We are very blessed in Minnesota in that we have Carol Ann Dahlberg as a resident here. She is a retired professor of education from Concordia College, Moorhead, and she is nationally recognized as an expert in this area of language learning for young learners. Her textbook, she is the co-author of the textbook that is literally the textbook that is used across the nation in training pre-service teachers in methodology, language acquisition, especially in the realm of teaching language to young learners. That is the author of the article that you have in front of you, and she has been an integral part of working with the New Visions Committee and will continue in the future. There's another article in there by her that addresses the pitfalls of planning in world language programs. That article dispels many of the myths when starting language programs. It outlines what model programs are not. So what are model programs? What is referred to in our legislation? We are looking at programs that have an extended sequence, something beyond the familiar 2 years at a high school to get an admission into college. We are looking at extended sequences that result in higher proficiency level of the students coming out of K-12 programs. That is the critical part. In order to have extended sequences, we need to start language learning with younger students. Some of the model programs that are around the nation are K-12 models, grades 5 through 12 models, and 7 through 12 models. So you have several years to acquire that higher language learning
income, proficiency. We need higher proficiency to meet the demands that are required of business, that are required of government, so that students, as they exit K-12 and go on to higher education, have the potential of developing the very high advanced foreign language skills that are needed for diplomacy and negotiation in business. Model programs can answer many of the questions that are how, that set out with how. As we talk with administrators, as we talk with parents in our communities, people understand the need for more world language in their communities, in their businesses. They get the picture. They understand the why. They understand the what. The questions that are out there begin with how. Administrators ask, how can I schedule a program like this in my district? How can I work it into the budget? How can we integrate another component into our curriculum? All of these questions start with how. And these are the questions that can be answered by model programs. The legislation calls for model programs in urban, suburban, and in rural districts, so that any school district across the state would have a model to look at as to how they can implement this type of a change in their own context. In closing, some food for thought. 2020 is the kind of vision we need to plan for the future. Children who enter kindergarten this year will graduate from high school in the year 2018. Most students do a couple of years of job training or coursework before they enter the work world. That brings us to the year 2020. In 2020, this year's kindergartners will be entering the world of work. They will be community members. They will be voting on national policy. Now is the time to think about what knowledge and what skills are needed in the year 2020. In education, we often refer to, when talking about standards and expectations, what do we expect students to know? What do we expect students to be able to do? In the context of closing the international gap, the knowledge is knowing about the world, understanding the cultures, and understanding global perspectives on a variety of issues. The do is the skill to be able to communicate with the world, communicate in the world's languages, and to communicate with cultural sensitivity to other cultures. Today's students will be the citizens and leaders of the 21st century, heirs to a world that grows smaller and smaller and more interconnected every day. For the United States to continue to prosper, all students must have opportunities to learn about other world regions and languages. The world will demand it of them. We need to demand it of our education system. As I've sat in on several committee meetings and listened to your work here, I came to realize that much of your work is really about setting the stage for new possibilities. What can happen in education? It's about setting the parameters where local decision makers can look at the context of the education that they want, the vision that they have for their students, and can find a way to make the change. This legislation is holding out a carrot to empower local decision makers to make these changes.
Thank you, Ms. Kitsap. Is there anyone else who wants to testify in favor of House File 827? Is there anyone who wants to testify in opposition to House File 827? Representative Greiling, I have a question of you, and maybe your testifiers can answer it. On page 1, line 13, the Quality Teaching Network is listed in the text of the sentence. A group, no doubt, that the commissioner shall seek input. Could you tell us what the Quality Teaching Network is and why it has been specifically named in this legislation?
Chair Erickson, the Quality Teaching
Network. Ms. Ratwick.
I'm sorry. because it was my understanding within the Department of Education that each of the discipline areas has a quality teaching network. I don't know how the rest of them are, but I know that relative to world languages, there is a group of about 15 teachers representing all different areas from the state that meet with the person that the Department of Education currently contracts with. And in addition to advising the person that is now half-time within the Department of Education for World Languages, sends information to them, they in turn dispel it further. These people also support and help teach seminars and teacher development programs around the state. So they're not just advisory to the Department of Education, but they also help do some of the in-service trainings that the Department of Education will pay for but don't have the people to actually teach.
Thank you. Is there anyone from the department in the audience?
Madam Chair.
Representative Freiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The staff person who covers international language from the department was here was it Friday or Thursday or whatever day we were here?
Friday.
Friday. And but now was unable to be here today.
Ms. Larson, counsel, is there any other place in statute where Quality Teaching Network is a part of our statute? Because there may be, we don't know, this network that the department often consults. Ms. Larson?
Madam Chair, members, I think there are two possibilities for addressing the question you raise on page 1, line 13 of the bill, House File 827. One would be to put the reference Quality Teaching Network into lowercase and after the word network insert within the department, or simply to delete the reference to the Quality Teaching Network and say input from the department, because the department would certainly include this particular network, even if it were not named.
Representative Greiling, how would you respond to that?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would offer the latter. The commissioner shall seek input from the department before designating or hiring the coordinator.
Representative Greiling, would you like to move that amendment?
I would, Madam Chair. I would strike on page 1, line 13, Quality Teaching Network, and insert department.
So, members, I believe you have to delete the Quality Teaching Network and insert with the department. So the sentence would read, on line 12, the commissioner, and then on line 13, shall seek input from within the department. Those would be the three inserted words before designating or hiring the coordinator. And Representative Greiling, you would like to incorporate that, I take it. So Representative Greiling does incorporate that change. Is there any discussion? Then we will have that change incorporated. Seeing no other questions. Oh, Representative Dabney.
Oh. Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to start by thanking Representative Greiling and the testifiers for coming forward with this. I do think this is an important area, and I appreciate the work you've done. It occurs to me, however, that, and I'd like some response, I think we've got, I'd like to see us expand our vision maybe a little bit further, because we've got bilingual students in our midst, our ELL population, but too often we see them as cost drivers, not as a resource. And these are young people that if we do right by them, not only will be bilingual, but bicultural, which is a much deeper set of skills that many foreign language students never really achieved, despite many years of studying a foreign language. And I'm just wondering if you could respond in any way. Thank you.
Ms. Ratwick.
Probably joined at the hip and say the same thing. Chairman Erickson, these programs are not excluded from this. And incorporating the strength of and the possibilities of programs with heritage learners is a very strong emphasis within the National American Council on the Teaching of World Languages. There are already programs doing that. There's one in St. Paul, there's one in Minneapolis, and I believe you know of another one also. their two-way language. They are both for the heritage learners than to many of the heritage. Well, I think you can probably speak to that and probably say the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Kittas? Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Dual language programs are one of the models, and in the way the legislation is written, local districts, if they wanted to start a dual language program, the legislation just says propose a model and look at the national models that are out there. And there is a model called dual language immersion, where you have, for example, children who are native speakers of Spanish together in a school and a classroom with children who are native speakers of English. And the goal of the program is for the Spanish-speaking children to learn English and the English-speaking children to learn Spanish. It's a very powerful dual immersion model.
Mm-hmm. Representative Daphne, any further questioning?
No, thank you.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I, too, would like to thank Representative Growling and the testifiers for their work on this. As you have noted, our world is getting smaller, and the importance of world languages is growing. And yet it seems to me that opportunities for students to learn foreign languages are decreasing. There's a disconnect here, and we absolutely need to do something to turn that around. I can understand how local school districts, when push comes to shove, that languages might get the shove. But it's our duty on a state level to look at this in a big picture way, just as it is nationally. And we have to stand up for what's right in the best interests of our country and our students overall. So that little bit of editorial comment I want to add to what's already been said. The question I have is, I don't believe we've addressed A1 as an amendment. Mm-hmm. We took A2 but not A1. Is A1 an amendment that you're also requesting, Representative Brown?
Just wanted
A2. Representative Lanning, I believe A2 replaced A1.
Right.
Okay.
And we did adopt.
Correct.
Thank you for the clarification. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Representative Lanning. Representative Sikora.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And either one of you ladies, could you describe, kind of for me, what of these model programs might look like? Let's just say you go do one in one of the suburban districts. Mm-hmm. And give me an idea of what the program might look like.
Ms. Kittas.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. A program that I had an opportunity to go and visit is in Glastonbury, Connecticut. It's one of the most renowned national models of foreign language programming that starts at the elementary grades. In Glastonbury, Connecticut, they have required foreign language for all of their students since 1954. Spanish and Russian are the main languages that they use in that district. Because of the need and the heritage in the community. In that program, students have language every day. With a program that I saw, it was a Spanish program. Students have Spanish for a half an hour every day, all during the school year. That brings up many of those how questions. How do they fit it into the curriculum without what loses if something is gained? And the wonderful news is that is when students have a strong enough, intensive enough of a program, they can develop the language skills to do parts of their core curriculum in the second language. So, for example, when I taught Spanish in Wayzata, I taught fourth graders. Geography was part of the fourth grade social studies curriculum. It was organized around the themes of studying the different continents of the world. And so in Spanish class, I could reinforce and enhance the social studies curriculum by doing geography in Spanish as well. It's like a two-for-one. It was another opportunity to see the maps and the capitals. I focused on the European community and Spain, and we could talk about all of these different things and learn the vocabulary and the questioning and play geography games in Spanish. We could learn Spanish and learn geography at the same time. And that's what many of these model programs can do. To enrich the curriculum, another way of reinforcing math concepts, art concepts, social studies, language arts, any of these. And so the language teachers work hand in hand with the classroom teachers in creating curriculum that is going to reinforce what is happening already at the grade level, so they don't lose time in their curriculum. They have another way of achieving the same goals.
Okay. Representative Carlson.
What happens when we have a 3-year grant and that grant runs out? Is the assumption then that the school is prepared and that the normal funding will carry the program from that point forward, and then we would give additional grants, assuming the future legislatures would also buy into additional school districts and expand that way?
Mm-hmm.
But I guess basically the question is, that are the ones that get those initial mm-hmm. grants then weaned after the 3 years and expected to make it on their own from that point forward.
Mm-hmm. Representative Carlson, if this bill prevails, we'll discuss that in education finance, but would you give concise yet limited, because our time is about up, Ms. Kitak, answer for us, please? Or, okay, Ms. Ratwick, I'm sorry.
Typically what has happened is that the startup costs are the most expensive aspect of these programs. Beyond that, most of your expenses still are in your teacher salary. And it would be hoped that the school districts will start to pick them up after that. However, on the other hand, most of the schools with strong language programs are attracting students from other areas. If you attract in either 10 or 12 new students, you've essentially paid the salary on that teacher. So they really are working even as a magnet in that respect. There are cases where I would imagine they might not be picked up, and we're talking about a whole variety of models here. These are not cookie cutter programs. So there's a large number of things that would happen to them. And as Chairman Erickson said, what happens beyond that? If we're back asking for more money, that wouldn't surprise me if we grow these programs. But on the other hand, I think there will be other funding coming along between now and 3 years from now.
Representative Carlson.
Just a follow-up. I'm still left not sure. I guess I was assuming was that the FTE then that would be generated after the 3 years would carry the program
mm-hmm.
forward like any other class offerings.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure from your comments if that was the way you viewed it when you said you'd be back for additional funding. Then would it be for those original programs to help them continue, or would the idea be then to have additional grants for additional school districts so that we would continue to expand foreign language programs at other sites?
Ms. Ratcliffe, Chair. I don't think that there is a definitive answer right now. I think that answer will come when we know what is happening with those programs. I mean, it's like any other program, any other models that you start, you really don't have that crystal ball. And I'm sorry, it's not a more definitive answer. I really don't have a definitive one. I do not see these grant programs continuing with the same program for 10, 12 years. I mean, that is not the intention of the model programs.
Mm-hmm.
But whether they need an additional grant for a time being, whether 3 years is enough. And it may also be that, depending upon the program, they have different needs for the level of continued funding.
Representative Clemson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, as far as to this point, one reason I'm very supportive of this kind of legislation is based on what I saw happen in Woodbury and that is they saw what was happening in Robbinsdale with their Spanish immersion program, which has really been a model for a lot of districts across the state. And I know that Woodbury is very dependent on trying to model what they've seen be successful, and they've gotten a lot of federal grants for this kind of thing. So I was hoping, you know, we could support a few more models and a few more sites in their efforts to emulate. But also Woodbury's putting forth a lot of their own money towards this program in trying to kind of just kind of reassess their priorities and seeing this as a priority, the Spanish program. And so that's why I'm very supportive of the model sort of philosophy.
Ms. Ratliff?
Another aspect to who pays for that is that slowly but surely the research is coming out, and I think it's going to start to have an impact on priorities. But students learning world languages, their scores are up right across the board in math, in science, in social studies. And I think as the decision makers start to realize that there are other ways than just the remedial route and redoing stuff and paying for a remedial teacher, that there are other ways of also achieving higher scores and closing that achievement gap. And one of them has been shown to be world languages. If you're paying a remedial teacher or you're paying a world language teacher, you're still paying one teacher's salary. And as the emphasis, as the changes come into the 21st century, I would hope that that would be one of the changes that we also see within education.
Representative Dreiling, closing comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I appreciate the thoughtful and very bipartisan discussion here tonight. And, you know, my interest in this bill, I stated at the beginning, I do think, to answer the financing question, that these grants would be to kind of salt and leverage interest and what is already there. And I would say, Representative Carlson, I would think that, generally speaking, FTEs, once they're established, would carry the program, and the grants could be used for other programs. We just have such exceedingly honest testifiers here that they just don't want to venture out and give a definitive answer in case that might happen in a case or two. But I would say that, you know, if we didn't have such honest testifiers up here, that would just be the clear answer, that that would be how the grants would end, and others could partake if we chose to authorize other grants in the future.
Representative Dreiling renews her motion that House File 827 as amended pass and be referred to the Committee on Education. All those in favor say yes. Yes.
Yes.
All those opposed say no.
No.
The bill passes and is re-referred to Education Finance. Thank you, Representative Dreiling, and
thank you
very much, testifiers.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there a food break right before we begin our last bill? Okay. 2 minutes to collect your food. And with that, Representative Diskins, if you want to go to the table, we'll be taking up House File 697, which was lain over by me on Friday.
You get out early childhood. There's only so much money. You don't have the money to restore early childhood. Yeah.
How much
money
is
it? We're sitting here, and I got a company that turned down a $45 million job for the government, because they couldn't find enough wealth.
literacy and the local government. We don't leave a lot of schools.
So the foreign languages, they wouldn't have took the foreign languages, they took the welding courses. Like, you're going to have 45 minutes, and it would have been a $200 million job.
Yeah, try to allow all the specialties. Some can find too much.
Well, it's happening all over. That's where we're outsourcing a lot of stuff. We don't have time.
I agree.
Well, my son-in-law works at Rogers, and he can't find diesel mechanics.
Sure.
We're going to have to outsource this one reason.
Can I say that the chair will pay for this?
Yeah.
Move it. Move that. I will. I like to build and walk.
No, I.
You know, how do we get food? I wasn't here to order them. So I missed the food because I wasn't here.
Do you want some fries?
Just a couple.
Here, I will take a few and you eat the rest.
Yes.
Here. Thank you.
I regret moving to that. It's so far that it was very hard for me to do that.
Into
the world.
Right.
I'm going to resist doing that. That's so far from protocol. That's what I'm never doing.
Members, we are on House File 697, and we were in the process of amending this bill when we adjourned last Friday. No, I don't know when it was. It doesn't make any difference. Representative Biskins.
Thank you.
This is your bill. Take it over.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and hopefully by the end of the evening, this is our bill. I'm feeling the love. All right. Madam Chair and members, I don't know if we need to formally bring the bill before the committee.
I will,
if
Representative
we do, I'd
Biskins.
Like to make that motion.
Yes. Representative Biskins moves that House File 697 be brought before the committee as it was amended whenever we last met on this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, I'd like to just make a very brief statement, and then I believe we are on the A3 amendment, and then we'll just go through the amendments, have our discussions, and take our votes. Madam Chair and members, now, the simple fact I'd like everyone to keep in mind is that the state offers financial support for low-income families in a variety of areas in this society. The state offers medical support and does not deny it to families because they use St. Francis in Shakopee versus a Fairview clinic in Edina. The state offers food stamps and does not restrict their use because a religious diet mandates kosher. The state offers financial support for a college education whether the student goes to Mankato or the student goes to Gus Davis. Members, which parent among us with the financial means wouldn't do whatever we could to help our child if he or she were failing in our public schools? If our children were facing academic failures as well as the pressures of drugs and gangs, I'm absolutely confident that everyone in here would look at private schools as a possible choice. Yet so many low-income children and their families are facing just that in Minneapolis and St. Paul. And without the full range of choices that we have, they're desperate and brokenhearted. Access grants are about the child, not about the public or the private system. At its core, it puts children first. I know in my heart that every member around this table believes that children are more important than all else. I hope and pray we keep that front and center as we move forward. And now, Madam Chair, I'll stand for amendments.
Thank you, Representative Biskins. We have before us the A3 amendment, and I do not have authors, so who is it who is moving the A3 amendment?
Madam Chair.
Representative Biskins.
Madam Chair, I'd ask that out of respect for committee members and their wide range of obligations tonight, that if the author of an amendment isn't present in the room, that we set that aside and come back to it at a later time.
Representative Biskins, so honored. The A4 amendment. And members, you do have these amendments in your packet, so if you recall when you might have recommended it for drafting, please confess. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, the A4 amendment is one that I wanted to propose and deals with teacher licensure, so I'd like to move the amendment to request a roll call vote.
Representative Carlson moves the A4 amendment and requests a roll call vote. Discussion.
And as I mentioned, it does deal with licensure. I'm interested in, one, ensuring quality and to make sure that the people who would be teaching in institutions then that would receive, or schools, public funding be of the same quality staff that we have in our public system. And just a couple of reminders, when you do graduate with an education degree in these days, and most of our colleges and universities, public or private, there are standards at the end of the college of education. There are standards in the major fields. There are courses to continue to keep your license that would be what I'll describe as continuing education during your teaching career to make sure that your license is new. I would also point out that then a person that would be hired in a school setting and receiving public money would also have had some experience. We have, for example, student teaching and that kind of preparation as well before one would begin their teaching career. So there's a lot of preparation in being a teacher. And private schools currently can have licensed teachers or not have licensed teachers, but if they're going to receive public funds, I think there should be one level of playing field relative to quality and to encourage members to support the community.
Representative Olson.
Representative Carlson, I'm just wondering, are you aware of any private schools that have significant levels of evidence of failure without these licensed teachers?
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Chair. We don't generally have the same kinds of requirements that we're now talking about for the public sector that might possibly determine failure, although the amendment that went on the other night dealing with testing and so on would give us some benchmarks. I'm not aware or couldn't give you a laundry list of schools that have failed. But I happen to think licensure is an important component relative to preparation for teaching, and I think everybody is enhanced by having that kind of a requirement in place.
Representative,
yes, Representative.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, I, with all due respect to your opinion about licensed teachers, the situation that's were created here is that people choosing to leave the public school, which is under the compulsory attendance law, basically, and at their discretion, they're going to private schools. And the years I've been here, I've never heard of any evidence, nor seen any evidence of private schools with significant levels of failure, nor any real substantive level of failure in the area of test scores. And in fact, the tests that I had here the other day in preparation for my amendment are far more comprehensive, have many more questions, covering more areas than our benchmarks. And that's why I have an amendment in the packet to basically sunset this provision, because I think it's only going to take us 3 years to figure out that they're doing very well with our admittedly by Commissioner Assistant Commissioner Olson, admittedly our sixth grade level tests, and yet the private schools are operating with tests every year and using nationally normed tests that are much more comprehensive. And when there's a failure, parents are free to leave and they can vote with their feet, and that kind of accountability, I think, has really established the system to be quite effective. And that's actually what's missing with the public system. It's hard for parents to vote with their feet. I think that's why, that's partly, I can't speak for Representative Biskins, but that's partly why I support this bill, because we're creating the ability for people to vote with their feet, for parents to vote with their feet, so to speak, and actually going to bring some real accountability to the public system and really improve the system. And I don't, after looking at and struggling with the teacher licensure rule here in Minnesota for a number of years, I have real difficulty, with all due respect to your opinion and to your position, I really have a hard time seeing that licensed teachers really assures the outcomes. I don't think that's where it's at. And the teacher licensure rule, you can go through that, and I think gives evidence to that. So I would then speak against your amendment with all due respect.
Roll call having been requested.
Madam Chair.
Representative Biskins, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, you know, I think that just fundamentally the money does not go to the private schools. The access grant is financial support to the parents. Let's understand the fundamental premise in the first place. In the second place, I would speak against this amendment simply because it would kill the bill. All right? Basically, private schools are fiercely independent and protective of their autonomy. When middle-income and upper-income families choose private schools, we do not add said strings. If this amendment were to go on the bill, I can't imagine a single private school allowing a low-income child to access this as a choice, so it takes that away. So I'd ask members to vote no on the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Biskins. Roll call having been requested, the clerk will take the roll.
Biskins?
No.
Erickson?
No.
Abler? Carlson?
Yes.
Sharon?
No.
Seibert?
No.
Dabney?
Yes.
Dean?
No.
Demmer?
No.
Dietrich?
Yes.
Dorn?
Yes.
Eastland?
No.
Eakin?
Yes.
Greiling?
Yes.
Heidgerken?
No.
Glinsing?
No.
Lanning?
No.
Latz?
Yes.
Mariani?
Yes.
Markwart?
Yes.
Norris?
No.
Olson?
No.
Kowalski?
Yes.
Peterson?
Yes.
Rude?
Yes.
Baylor?
Yes.
Severson?
No.
Sikora?
No.
Wardlow?
No.
Good.
There being 13 yeses and 15 noes, the amendment does not prevail.
Madam Chair?
Representative Biskins.
Madam Chair, perhaps we'd like to revert back to the A3 amendment out of respect for the author of that amendment.
Thank you, Representative Biskins. Is there anyone who confesses to the A3 amendment? Representative Brood?
Yes.
Representative Brood moves Amendment A3. Please explain your amendment, Representative Brood.
Members, this is a fairly straightforward amendment. All it says is that schools that accept public dollars must comply with Title II of the Federal Americans with Disabilities Act. If we are talking about access, that is really what this addresses, is strictly access.
Okay. Representative Vistens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, again, I will state that private schools are fiercely independent of their autonomy. We do not put strings on private schools when middle and upper income families choose private schools. I will say again that the school itself does not get an access grant. An access grant is financial aid to the families. I believe that this would have a severe detriment to the bill and would ensure that no low-income child could choose access grants as a means to hopefully bettering themselves. I'd ask for no vote.
Representative Root has mouthed that she wants a roll call, so there will be a roll call. And who has a question? Representative Dorn.
Madam Chair, I'll speak in favor of the amendment. It does seem to me there is a fundamental difference, which is why we're having this debate, and that is in the current structure, the middle and upper income families don't have access grants that are provided through the public dollars. And so I think we're making a fundamental change in terms of the source of the money, and that opens up the discussion as to what should be the delivery of service for the students now who will be, to some extent, funded with taxpayers' dollars. And the second point, I suppose, is I think Representative Biskins, I suppose everybody in this room would probably argue this one for weeks and months, is just the question of whether or not just because we track the funding through a check that has an unrestricted or a restricted endorsement is a mechanism, but I would still say it is the fact that the student is going to the school, that the money goes to the school, which I would say is essentially the same as what is happening in terms of how we fund our schools, too. So we just have, I think, a very fundamental different point of view on that, but given, I want to articulate that because that is a reason why I would be voting yes on this amendment.
Madam Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Representative Dorn, and every member of this committee, I appreciate greatly the difference in philosophical thoughts on all of the issues and have enjoyed from day one of this committee having these debates. I still ask you to vote no.
The clerk will take the roll.
Biskin.
No.
Erickson.
No.
Abler. Carlson.
Yes.
Sharon.
No.
Seibert.
No.
Dabney.
Yes.
Dean.
No.
Zimmer.
No.
Dietrich.
Yes.
Dorn.
Yes.
Eastland.
No.
Eakin.
Yes.
Greiling.
Yes.
Heidgerken.
No.
Klinzing.
No.
Lanning.
No.
Latch.
Yes.
Mariani.
Yes.
Markwart.
Yes.
Norna.
Yes.
Yes, you're here, Norna.
Olson.
No.
Lauk.
Yes.
Peterson.
Yes.
Rude.
Yes.
Taylor.
Yes.
Severson.
No.
Sikora.
No.
Wardlow.
No.
There being 13 yeses and 15 noes, the motion does not prevail and is not adopted. the A5 amendment called Pupil Fair Dismissal Act.
Madam Chair.
Representative Greiling moves the A5 amendment. Please explain your amendment, Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I request a roll call vote, please.
And she requests a roll call. That'll be.
Okay. This one is requiring that school districts that are accepting these accent grant payments would also follow the Pupil Fair Dismissal Act that public schools follow. And I once had a friend who is an administrator in the Roseville area schools who said he, being a Catholic boy, would be open to vouchers if he just hadn't seen all the kids from Hill Murray coming back after the second, third, and fourth week of school. They got accepted, but as soon as something went wrong, then they were sent back to the public schools, and therefore the public schools have to deal with sometimes more difficult students. So I think this creates an even playing field, and that's why I'm bringing this forward.
Representative Viskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members, Supreme Court has said that the parent is not an inconsequential conduit when it comes to vouchers, and I think that's a very important point to remember, that the school itself does not get public dollars. All right? Public dollars is financial aid to the parents and families to choose to at least have the ability to make school choice. The premise, I think, is still wrong on this one, and I would encourage, because again, you know, the undue strings attached would make the program unworkable for poor children, and therefore I'd ask that you vote no.
The clerk will take the roll.
Viskins.
No.
Erickson.
No.
Abler. Carlson.
Yes.
Sharon.
No.
Seibert.
No.
Dabney.
Yes.
Dean.
No.
Demmer.
No.
Dietrich.
Yes.
Dorn.
Yes.
Eastland.
No.
Eakin.
Yes.
Greiling.
Yes.
Heidkirchen.
No.
Klinzing.
No.
Lanning.
No.
Blatt.
Yes.
Mayani.
Yes.
Markwart.
Yes.
Nornis.
No.
Olson.
No.
Kowalski.
Yes.
Peterson.
Yes.
Rude.
Yes.
Taylor.
Yes.
Severson.
No.
Sikora.
No.
Wardlow.
No.
There being 13 yeses and 15 noes, the amendment does not prevail and is not adopted. The A7 amendment.
Madam Chair?
Yes. Representative Latz moves the A7 amendment. Please explain your amendment, Representative Latz.
Madam Chair, I ask for roll call.
Yes, and roll call you shall have.
Madam Chair, Amendment A7 would require that all schools receiving an access grant through students would be required to comply with the state data practices requirements under Chapter 13 and with comparable federal data practices requirements that apply to public schools.
Sort of like money laundering. If you send your money overseas and then you send it right back electronically, you can follow the path, but you know where it's going and you know where it came from. State money going through students or through any other mechanism to private schools or private parochial schools, it's clearly the manifest intent of this legislation to direct public money toward private schools. Indeed, that is the primary justification for this, is to give current public school students the ability to go to private schools. No matter what the Supreme Court has said, there's already ample legislative record that the specific intent of this legislation is to facilitate that transmission of funds through whatever conduit. This would indeed require that, following those public funds, are the requirements of state law in connection with Chapter 13, classifying a whole variety of data as educational data, and also requiring that that data be protected as specified in Chapter 13, and where also so specified that that data be public and available for a public review and analysis. So I ask for your support for this amendment.
Representative Viskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, no matter what the Supreme Court has said, Again, you know, at the risk of sounding redundant, the money does not go to the school. The money goes as financial aid to the parents and families looking for alternatives. This amendment, were it to be adopted, would essentially ensure that no low-income child could use this as a means of expanding their school choice capabilities, and therefore I'd ask for a no vote.
The clerk will take the roll.
Biskin.
No.
Erica.
No.
Abler. Carlson.
Yes.
Sharon.
No.
Seibert.
No.
Dabney.
Yes.
Dean.
Nope.
Summer.
No.
Dietrich.
Yes.
Dorn.
Yes.
Eastland.
No.
Eakin.
Yes.
Greiling.
Yes.
Heidgerken.
No.
Glinsey.
No.
Lanning.
No.
Latz.
Yes.
Mariani.
Yes.
Markworth.
Yes.
Nornis.
No.
Olson.
No.
Kowalski.
Yes.
Peterson.
Yes.
Rude.
Yes.
Saylor.
Yes.
Severson.
No.
Sikora.
No.
Wardlow.
No.
There being 13 yeses and 15 noes, the amendment is not adopted. The A8 amendment, open meeting law.
Madam Chair, I'll move the A8 amendment.
Representative Dorn moves the A8 amendment. Please explain your amendment, Representative Dorn.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and it's certainly an issue we have seen before and one that I think the committee needs to keep looking at in terms of all of the boards that are in charge of decisions that affect our kids in terms of everything from their enrollment to their performance, et cetera. And members, I think complying with the open meeting law, having to set the agenda, having to meet at a specified time, allowing people to come and receive the materials and the handouts is something that is just good public policy for those boards. As you know, I have concerns that we haven't been as consistent as perhaps we need to be even on the public sector. But I plan to be consistent on this issue and raise the issue across the board for all the boards. I think it's just it's good for the public to have those decisions made. And again, I would cite the same points I made earlier. I'm not sure potentially how many public dollars we would be talking about that would be involved in all of the access grants, but I think they would be large enough to certainly justify having decisions made under the open meeting law. So I urge your support and ask for a roll call vote if I didn't ask for a roll call.
Roll call has been asked for. Representative Distance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, it's not my intent with this piece of legislation to fundamentally change the nature, workings, and operations of private schools. In fact, I believe that if any amendment were to go on to this bill, which fundamentally changes the nature, governance, structure of private schools, that it would basically make the legislation moot and therefore prohibit low-income children from using educational access grants to further their education. Therefore, I'd ask for no vote.
The clerk will take the roll.
Siskins.
No.
Erickson.
No.
Abel. Carlson.
Yes.
Strong.
No.
Seibert.
No.
Dabney.
Yes.
Dean.
No.
Summer.
No.
Dietrich.
Yes.
Dorn.
Yes.
Eastland.
No.
Eakin.
Yes.
Greiling.
Yes.
Heidgerken.
No.
Clinton.
No.
Lanning.
No.
Latz.
Yes.
Mariani.
Yes.
Markworth.
Yes.
Norner.
No.
Olson.
No.
Kowalski.
Yes.
Peterson.
Yes.
Rude.
Yes.
Saylor.
Yes.
Severson.
No.
Sikora.
No.
Wardlow.
There being 13 yeses and 15 noes, the amendment fails and it's not adopted. The A9 amendment. who confesses to this one?
I confess not. I withdraw it because I have another amendment.
Representative Eakin withdraws the A9 amendment, the A10 amendment.
Aye, Madam Chair. Sandra Peterson.
Representative Peterson moves the A10 amendment.
And I'd like
please
a roll
explain
call.
Your amendment, and yes, there will be a roll call.
Thank you. This is very clear. It just says that you can't raise the total amount of school tuition or fees to in any one year to exceed the percent increase in the formula allowance between the preceding and the current fiscal year. And that's to keep the school's affordability in place and also to create an atmosphere of fiscal accountability that these grants can go to students with low income.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. While I appreciate at the very superficial level what Representative Peterson is trying to do here, I think what we need to realize at the deepest level is that private schools are in the free market. If a private school were to increase its tuition and fees to a rate higher than is specified in this bill, it would affect all of their children, the vast majority of which they have, which are not Access Grant students. They're operating in a whole different realm than a public system which has a guaranteed geographical monopoly. I believe once again that if this amendment were adopted, it would essentially get the bill in such a way that no low-income child would be able to use this as a means to hopefully further their education, and I'd ask for a no vote.
Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. And I don't want this just to be a rote back and forth here, so I do want to challenge Representative Biskins to think about something in regards to this amendment. I know I actually have had my children in parochial schools when they were very young. They both graduated from public schools since then. So I have a little bit of experience with both those systems. And I could tell you that one of the ways in which particularly parochial schools make ends meet is that the religious community that they're affiliated with will make sacrifices in the form of usually collections, I imagine, at in their service on Sundays, sometimes specific collections for the purpose of supporting the operations of the school. There are also scholarship dollars and other forms of fundraising that goes on. Some of these are driven by individual need or individual desires, but some, quite frankly, are part of the institution's behavior. These institutions, in many ways, are not different from our public institutions in this regard, and that is that they face financial burdens and issues in other areas of their work. And so I want you just to think about this, Representative Biskins, and we could talk more about this in the future, but if we start filling a certain part of their huge, just their finances with what up to now are public funds, it's common logic would dictate that we at least create the opportunity for a financial incentive for those institutions to take their current investments in their schools and put them to other equally important areas of work. It could be mission work. It could be responding to the increase in liability lawsuits that some of the religious communities have seen in recent years due to inappropriate behavior of a small percentage of their ordained members. I don't raise the issue to be provocative. I raise the issue, I think, as any good economist would raise the issue, which is you may be running the risk here of creating a disincentive for investments and an incentive to release current revenue streams from these institutions to deal with other issues. And at some point, the public might be asking, are we in fact then not indirectly subsidizing whatever other activity that those institutions may now be choosing to invest those resources in. So I think I know how the vote's going to be here, but I just, you know, want folks to know that behind each and every one of these amendments, there are hours and hours of very careful deliberation and thought that I think we need to be engaged in order to move forward on a big proposal such as this one.
Representative Diskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, members of the committee. Again, I will say that I'm sensitive to what Representative Peterson is trying to do here. All right, I think this is the First Amendment that I went off with that as a statement. And I want both Representative Peterson and Representative Mariani to know that if this legislation is does move forward from this committee onto the Committee on Finance, that I would very much like to work with you on this component in particular. It's one that gives me pause. I think the amendment, the spirit behind it is well done, and I'd like to work on language which would be comfortable for both sides of the aisle if this piece of legislation moves forward. But at this time, again, I'd ask for a no vote.
Representative Lance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not being a member of the Finance Committee, and since this is indeed the Policy Committee and there's an important policy component to this decision here, I'd encourage members to put this amendment on the bill, and then if there is to be any further policy work done on it, then let that happen in the next context. But right now we have the opportunity specifically to deal with the money trail. Money is fungible, and you put a dollar into a pot, it does indeed free up dollars for other purposes, or it can increase the pot for both specific educational, in many cases parochial educational purposes. And I wish to clarify my earlier comment, yes, notwithstanding the Supreme Court, more to the point, notwithstanding whether or not these practices are considered constitutional by the present membership of the United States Supreme Court, there are important policy questions here which need to be addressed. And to me, the very important policy question is, should public taxpayer dollars be used to fund parochial education or other private education when public schools, on its own merits, and then separately and especially when public schools are crying out for lack of funding as well? This goes very directly to that question, more so than any of the other amendments I believe have up to this point. So I think the very pointed question is, are we prepared to say that we want to spend public tax dollars on private school education? This very much creates the opportunities and indeed does that, and I urge you to vote for the amendment.
Representative Diskins.
Madam Chair, I appreciate that. I'll come back to my opening statement. This bill is about children, not systems. I'd appreciate a no vote.
A roll call has been requested. The clerk will take the roll.
Diskins.
No.
Erickson.
No.
Abler. Carlson.
Yes.
Sharon.
No.
Seibert.
No.
Dabney.
Yes.
Dean.
Yep.
Dummer.
No.
Dietrich.
Yes.
Dorn.
Yes.
Eastland.
No.
Eakin. Dorn.
Yes.
Eastland.
No.
Eakin.
Yes.
Greiling.
Yes.
Heidgerken.
No.
Clinzing.
No.
Lanning.
No.
Latt.
Yes.
Mariani.
Yes.
Marquardt.
Yes.
Norna.
No.
Olson.
No.
Kowalski.
Yes.
Peterson.
Yes.
Rude.
Yes.
Saylor.
Yes.
Severson.
No.
Sikora.
No.
Wardlow.
No.
There being 13 yeses and 15 noes, the amendment is not adopted. The A-12 amendment. Representative Mariani moves the A-12 amendment. Please explain your amendment, Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate it, and I would ask for a roll call on this amendment.
Roll call there will be.
Madam Chair, this goes to the issue of selectivity and non-discrimination. In access to schools, While I appreciate the independence of private schools, and I will fight to the death to protect their right to set their rules with private dollars, I do think that public dollars require a different level of scrutiny and expectation. And I would note that even our private colleges and private hospitals are subject to review on the issue of non-discrimination, and many of them embrace that in addition wholeheartedly. I also just want to say that while I appreciate that the bill is structured and written in a way to meet or attempt to meet some standards set by some court decisions in terms of a check being written to parents as opposed to directly to an institution, there really is no doubt that the money gets used to support an infrastructure that in a parochial setting is an infrastructure that, among other things, is used to promote either a religious faith or, in the case of my amendment, quite frankly, to promote the ability of the institution to be selective. And again, as I stated earlier, with private dollars, I have no problem with folks choosing to exercise that level of selectivity. This language is similar, if I'm remembering right, from a few years back with some issues that we've dealt with open enrollment. I think perhaps with desegregation enrollment, I'm not quite sure, but basically says that in a school that is accepting, and we use the word here participating school, but accepting students under this program, that they must enroll a student if that student applies, unless they're filled to capacity at a particular grade level, in which case at that point the school must accept students based on a lottery. To be clear, the language goes on to say that such a school must not reject the student's application based on a number of indicators, things like previous academic achievement, athletic or other extracurricular activity, disabling conditions, proficiency in the English language, previous disciplinary proceedings, or even the district of residence. And so this is really the non-discrimination part of the amendment. So, Madam Chair, with that, I would stand for any questions.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members. I think this amendment would put a greater burden on private schools than we even have in the public school system. I think it's a misnomer in the public school system to say that they accept all children. That simply is not true. Representative Wardlow, you and I know that there's a school within our district at Dakota Ridge, right, where a student who may be coming to Blackhawk, where I work, or Dakota Hills, where you work, where both of those schools can reject that student's application, all right, and say, no, you belong over yonder. In my hometown of Jordan, we have another school that takes students of severe behavioral disabilities. The way this amendment is worded, Madam Chair and members, we place an even higher burden on public schools simply because they are going to say, we're going to accept a low-income child who is getting financial aid. All right? We're going to place an even greater burden on them than we have on any of our public schools at this point. I'd ask for no vote.
Representative Clinzing.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Mariani, where it says other status protected, what is listed under other status protected, and does it include things like age?
Representative Mariani.
Yeah, Chair and Representative Clinzing, I would ask our counsel to help me with that.
Ms. Larson.
Section of law.
Just give her a moment to find the reference. Ms. Larson.
Madam Chair, members, in Chapter 363A, which governs the Minnesota Human Rights Act, Section 363A.02 talks about freedom from discrimination. It states that it is the public policy of the state to secure for persons in this state freedom from discrimination. Clause 5, in education because of race, color, creed, religion, national origin, sex, marital status, disability, status with regard to public assistance, sexual orientation, and age.
Representative Klinzing, did you have a follow-up?
Well, clearly this particular amendment would put restrictions on private schools that don't even exist for public schools, which already restrict based on age. So if our public schools would be in violation of this particular amendment.
Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, I'll ask a blind question, always knowing that you don't know the answer to it. It could come back to bite you, but... I wonder if Ms. Larson could tell me whether public schools are subject to Chapter 363A.
Ms. Larson.
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, I believe that they are. There are specific provisions related to educational institutions.
Thank you, Ms. Larson.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, we heard some very compelling and strong testimony from both proponents and opponents of this bill the other night. And I have to say, quite frankly, I don't totally disagree with some of the concerns expressed by the proponents of the bill. We heard from a number of communities of color in particular. I can tell you, Madam Chair, that I think it would be their expectation that if they're, I would think, and I don't want to presume to speak for them, but I would think that it would be their expectation that if this program were to be enacted into law, that they would want those schools to comply with these non-discriminatory provisions. It seems to me that that was part of the argument that they were laying before us, was the incredible inequity that exists in all our institutions because of the unfortunate and harmful and lingering effects of racism in our society.
Representative Biscuits.
Madam Chair, I'm prepared to vote.
The clerk will take the roll.
Biscuits.
No.
Erickson.
No.
Abler. Carlson.
Yes.
Sharon.
No.
Seibert.
No.
Dabney.
Yes.
Dean.
Nope.
Summer.
No.
Dietrich.
Yes.
Dorn.
Yes.
Eastland.
No.
Eakin.
Yes.
Greiling.
Yes.
Heidgerken.
Nope.
Klinzing.
No.
Lanning.
No.
Lax.
Yes.
Mariani.
Yes.
Markworth.
Yes.
Nornis.
No.
Olson.
No.
Pulaski.
Yes.
Peterson.
Yes.
Rude.
Yes.
Saylor.
Yes.
Severson.
No.
Sikora.
No.
Wardlow.
There being 13 yeses and 15 noes, the amendment does not prevail and is not adopted. We stand in recess, members, for 5 minutes. So please return at 5:10. Representative Biscuits?
I'd ask that we ask the committee to return at 9 o'clock.
At 9 o'clock. Thank you, Representative Biscuits. Return, please, at 9 o'clock. Members, we have the 814 amendment before us. Someone's having some fun here with Representative Biscuits. Who confesses to it?
Oh, I still have my good question.
814 amendment. Representative Dabney withdraws the amendment.
Correct.
Representative Dabney withdraws the 814 amendment.
And I told him I'd help him.
Thank you, Representative Dabney.
You're welcome.
Representative Olson offers the LLHRD amendment. Representative Olson, will you explain your amendment, please?
Madam Chair, in the spirit of cooperation, I'll withdraw my amendment, too.
Representative Olson withdraws his amendment. Thank you, Representative Olson.
Is this April 1st, Madam Chair?
No, it's not.
Okay.
But it was April 1st, almost 5 days ago, so thank you. The A18 amendment.
Madam Chair.
Representative Eakin.
Yes, I'd like to move the A18 amendment for passage.
Representative Eakin moves the A18 amendment. Please explain your amendment.
Okay, and I'd also like to ask for a roll call.
And a roll call you shall have.
Thank you. Members, this amendment requires that only a school that's making adequate yearly progress is able to accept the initial application for these access grants. And it also requires that each year the school must meet the state expectations for adequate yearly progress in order to continue receiving these access grants. And basically what it's about is it's about accountability and making sure that our public dollars are being spent wisely for these students. So I would encourage your support for the A18 amendment. Thank you.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, this would essentially get the bill again. It's the autonomy of the private schools that are important, and it's also very important to understand, members, that an access grant being tuition aid to parents and their families is just that. It's not a school receiving the money. It's families making the decision, and some families are choosing to select non-public schools simply based on the fact that they don't have all of the strings attached by to public schools. Again, if this amendment were to go on the bill, it would ensure that no low-income child could use the access grants as a means to broaden their choices. Therefore, I ask that a no vote be given on the Eakin amendment.
The clerk will take the roll.
Biskin.
No.
Erickson.
No.
Ibler. Carlson.
Yes.
Sharon.
No.
Seibert.
No.
Dabney.
Yes.
Dean. Dummer.
No.
Dietrich.
Yes.
Storm.
Yes. I'm waiting for Representative Pulowski.
No.
Eakin.
Yes.
Griling.
Yes.
Heidkirchen.
Glinzing.
No.
Lanning.
No.
Latt.
Yes.
Mariani. Mariani. Marquardt.
Yes.
Nornis.
No.
Olson.
No.
Plowski. Plowski. Peterson.
Yes.
Rude.
Yes.
Saylor.
Yes.
Severson.
No.
Sikora.
No.
Wardlow.
No.
There being 11 yeses and 15 noes, the amendment is not adopted. The A21 amendment.
Oh.
Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair, this is the A21 amendment. It's mine. I'd like to move it before the committee and ask for a roll call vote. I unfortunately don't seem to have a copy of it, which is a little disappointing. Thank you.
Please explain your amendment.
I'm trying to.
And we understand. I know what this is like. I had it.
Thank you. The language in the A21 amendment parallels language in the governor's Department of Revenue bill. In that bill, he proposes that if you take a tax credit, such as the education tax credit, the working families tax credit, and so on, fraudulently, that you are prohibited from taking that tax credit for 10 years. And so this simply parallels the governor's proposal there. And this is I think this is one that we can all agree on, and I would hope that the author of the bill would support me. Given the problems that voucher programs in other states have had with fraud, if you look at the Milwaukee program, for instance, the head of the Exetio High School was charged with several criminal counts and found guilty of falsifying enrollment figures to receive more tax dollars from the state. The founder and director of the Milwaukee Preparatory was charged with mishandling public funds and fraud. Wisconsin taxpayers paid those two schools an estimated $390,000 for services that were never provided. The chief executive officer of Alex's Academies of Excellence, I don't make this stuff up, folks, was convicted of tax fraud. And the judge in that case says it seems that in referring to voucher programs is easy pickings for people who are not inclined to be honest. There have been grave problems in Florida with their voucher program with schools that nobody could find when they went to mail the check, that lumped all the kids K through 12 into the same classroom and took literally hundreds of thousands of dollars in state aid with little or no nothing to show for it. I don't think any of us, whether we support this bill or not, want to see fraud perpetrated on the taxpayers in Minnesota. So I'd ask for your support on this amendment.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, Representative Dabney. I appreciate your bipartisan efforts in trying to prepare well the governor's language. I do have some concern with the language of this bill, knowing full well that we already have laws in place which punish those who intentionally defraud the government. I'm concerned particularly about the extent of the 10-year period. Essentially, if a parent or family were to make a bad decision early on, it bars them essentially from ever accessing the program again. I believe in forgiveness, all right, as I know you all have for bringing up athletics bill that Representative Greiling and I put forward, and you forgave me, and I appreciate that. but at this point, I'd ask a no vote on this amendment.
Representative Sikora.
Well, essentially, I was going to say similar to what Representative Biskin said, that I think visiting the fact that the parent or guardian may have lied about something and prohibiting a child from being even in that program for 10 years is a little bit much and a little overly mean. And when we talk about the fact that there have been records falsified, et cetera, yes, I believe that happens, and I believe that has happened in our public school system not that long ago, as a matter of fact. So, I just think this is a really mean-spirited amendment, and I would say we should be voting no.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Sikora, for bringing up the concern of not too long ago. I actually consulted with the commissioner just the other day on this subject. I have a school district who has been consistently reporting or allowing students to come late and leave early and still report a full day for their attendance. And I think this is an issue that does need to be looked at within the public school, and hope that we can do so. The students are being justified in not attending the entire day and not even getting, in some cases, a half day, because they've met the basic skills standard, which is minimum competency, and as we know by the previous testimony here, it's not even that. So I would concur, and thank you.
The clerk will take the roll.
Biskin.
No.
Erickson.
No.
Abler.
No.
Carlson.
Yes.
Sharon.
No.
Cyber.
No.
Dabney.
Yes.
Dean.
Nope.
Summer.
No.
Dietrich.
Yes.
Storm.
No, shorter,
yes.
Shorter, don't
we? Eastland.
Nope.
Ethan.
Yes.
Greiling.
Yes.
Heidgerken.
No.
Clinzing.
No.
Lanning.
No.
Latz.
Yes.
Mariani.
Yes.
Markworth.
Yes.
Nornis.
No.
Olson.
No.
Kowalski.
Yes.
Peterson.
Yes.
Rude.
Yes.
Taylor.
Yes.
Severson.
No.
Sikora.
No.
Wardlow.
No.
There being 13 yeses and 16 noes, the amendment does not prevail and is not adopted. The A22 amendment. Madam Chair, I would like to move that amendment. Representative Seiler moves the A22 amendment. Please explain your amendment.
This would refer to making a few slight changes on page 2, line 13, to delete 2011 and insert 2010 instead. Page 2, line 21, delete in fiscal year 2012 and. And page 2, delete the lines 22 and 23. Then page 4, after line 10, insert the Office of Educational Accountability under section 120B.31, subdivision 3, by January 15, 2010, must evaluate the educational and financial efficacy of the program under this section and submit a written report to the legislature recommending whether or not to continue to expand the program. And this section expires June 30th, 2010. Line 14, page 14, after line 18, insert effective date, the amended language in this section expires June 30th, 2010.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. I just had neglected. I don't want to break with the recently established tradition.
Like
and I
a
would.
Roll call.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes.
Thank you.
A roll call you shall have. Representative Biskins.
Madam Chair, that was going to be my first question to Representative Seiler. I'm interested in a roll call or not on this amendment. My second question, and I'm not going to pose it as a question, I'll just make it part of my statement. Had this have come as two separate amendments, because there really are two separate ideas here, I could find strong support for the latter, right? And that is the evaluation component, I think, is good and appropriate and proper, and one, Representative Saylor, if this bill moves forward, that I'd like to work with you on putting an amendment together to have that evaluation piece. I think that's good. The piece that I think is a part that doesn't work for the author of the bill is the part that actually puts in a sunset on the entire program. Folks, we're talking about children, we're talking about families, we're talking about their lives. Now, we all know, every one of us sitting around here, that every time the legislature meets, everything in the statute book is fair game. So if there is a program that isn't working, the legislature always has the option to, in effect, sunset the program, terminate the program. But to set out right from the get-go that the program's going to be terminated, I think, is unfair to the children and the families who may be very successful by the use of this program. And so at this time, I'd ask for a no vote on this amendment.
Representative Seiler.
Madam Chair and Representative Biskins, I would just like to submit to you that because this is sort of a new concept, maybe it would deserve some accountability, looking at it through the OEA. And I think that moving to sunset it until it could be adequately assessed by that department would simply be my intent. Thank you.
And Representative Saylor, I apologize for mispronouncing your name. I know better. I'm just getting a little tired here. The clerk will take the roll.
Biskins.
No.
Erickson.
No.
Abler.
No.
Carlson.
Aye.
Sharon.
No.
Seibert.
No.
Dabney.
Yes.
Dean.
Nope.
Summer.
No.
Dietrich.
Yes.
Thorne.
Yes.
Eastland.
Nope.
Eakin.
Yes.
Briley.
Yes.
Heidkirchen.
No.
Plunzing.
No.
Lanning.
No.
Latz.
Yes.
Mariani.
Yes.
Markwart.
Yes.
Snornis.
No.
Olson.
No.
Blowski.
Yes.
Peterson.
Yes.
Rood.
Yes.
Saylor.
Yes.
Severson.
No.
Sikora.
No.
Wardlow.
No.
There being 13 yeses and 16 noes, the amendment is not adopted.
Madam Chair.
Representative Abler. Welcome.
Sorry, I've not been around. I've been engaged in other committees and other projects. I apologize to members for missing all the fun of this committee. It's not because I didn't want to be here. I had a child with an eye injury one night and a day job that took me away. And I realize I missed a good deal of the fun tonight. And the fun looks like it's going to continue on with more and more amendments. So, Madam Chair, I suggest that we engage in what I would consider to be a test vote. I would move to table the bill.
Representative Biskins.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, to the Abler motion, I think that the people who have worked long and hard on this bill and the children and families it's meant to help deserve to have a fair hearing that you have given it, Madam Chair, over an extended period of time and deserve a vote on the bill. Madam Chair and members, I'd ask a no vote on the Abler amendment so that we can bring this bill to a vote, all right, and so that we're not leaving people hanging out wondering what are they going to do now. I think it's only fair and just that we vote on this bill. So I'd ask a no vote for the Abler motion.
Point of order.
Representative Abler, do you want a roll call on that?
What does the body want to say on it? I feel like a shaking head. So people want to know what people think. And Madam Chair, it's not meant to be disrespectful, not to debate the motion. I don't know if it's debatable or not.
Obviously, it's not debatable. But
okay, but just this is a vote. This is a bona fide vote on the bill. And I think that you can do amendments until midnight and suffer harm to your families, which mine would be suffering harm if I got home that late. And you would be no further along in the debate than you are now. I missed the in-depth discussion about the ADA and about the every other requirement you could have possibly discussed relative to this bill, but I think I'm ready to cast a vote, and I think members are too. So if the people want to discuss longer, they can simply vote against the motion to table, and if they want to go home, they can do the other.
So
I'd like a roll call vote. The chair will. The clerk will take the roll.
No, it was just laid over. We should have had a
Biskin.
No.
Erickson.
No.
Abler.
Yes.
Carlson.
Yes.
Sharon.
No.
Seibert.
No.
Gavney.
Yes.
Dean.
Nope.
Dummer.
No.
Dietrich.
Yes.
Dorn.
Yes.
Eastland.
No.
Eakin.
Yes.
Riling.
Yes.
Heidgerken.
Yes.
Klinzing.
No.
Lanning.
No.
Latz.
Yes.
Mariani.
Yes.
Markwart.
Yes.
Nornis.
No.
Olson.
No.
Pulowski.
Yes.
Peterson.
Yes.
Rood.
Yes.
Saylor.
Yes.
Severson.
No.
Sikora.
No.
Wardlow.
No. The motion does prevail with 15 yeses and 14 noes. The bill is tabled.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Biskins, anything else?
Madam Chair, I believe there's minutes in our packet.
Yes, there are some minutes. I thought maybe in light of the fact that you've worked so hard to bring forth this bill for what we heard the other night, members, was the lack of expectations for our minority children, and it disappoints me greatly that we can't follow through with moving forth this bill when we heard such compelling testimony and have so much to think about in regard to the education of our children.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Madam Chair? The most compelling testimony that I heard was my own superintendent, who said simply, if you care about the education of minority children, fund the Minneapolis schools the way they deserve to be funded.
Madam Chair?
Representative Viskins. No, I don't know. Who's speaking to me?
I moved approval of the minutes.
No, I haven't actually gotten to that yet, but Representative Carlson does move approval of the minutes. All those, are there any corrections or additions? All those in favor signify by saying yes. Yes.
No.
Those opposed, same sign.
No.
Oh, good. Yeah. The minutes are approved, though, even though there's one nay vote. And members, this meeting stands adjourned.